So tonight we're continuing with this series of talks I've been giving on the Four Noble Truths. And we've got all the way to number four. Think about the Four Noble Truths, there's so much there that I divided it into three talks to really cover it thoroughly. And it's the Four Noble Truth sort of divides very nicely into these three different sections. You know, there's what's often called the wisdom section, then there's the virtue section, and then there's the practice section. And remember, the Fourth Noble Truth is, you know, it's called the path, right? It's the way to realize the truth of the first three Noble Truths. Especially the Third Noble Truth says, well, if you want to stop suffering, just quit clinging. Casually, it says that. And then the whole Four Noble Truth is basically, well, but how do you do that? How could you possibly accomplish that? Right? And so these first two, wise understanding and wholesome intention, sometimes called wise view, these are called the wisdom factors. These are things we, if anything, think about more, figure out more, get a sense of more than some of the other things. And I want to start by reading a little bit from the Majjhima Nikaya here. This is a sutta on right view. How convenient. This is the Buddha. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong view as wrong view, and right view as right view. That's pretty simple, yeah. This is one's right view. And what, bhikkhus, is right view? Right view, I say, is twofold. There is right view that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in acquisitions, and there is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. I want to point out the word taints here. Taints, often we think of that as sort of like something bad, it's tainted, right? Taints here means that they're colored. It's like things are colored by. They're not, because they're based in the world of relative reality, they're often colored and not as clear as what he calls supramundane right view. He goes on. And what, bhikkhus, is right view that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions? There's what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There's fruit and result of good and bad actions. There's this world and the other world. There's mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. There are in the world good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declared this world an other world. This is right view affected by taints, partaking of merit, and ripening in the acquisitions. So this is quite a list. You know, typical Buddha, you know, we can't just say one thing, we'll make a big long list about it, right? And I want to look at some of these. And the first part is he's talking about there's what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. He's talking about generosity. Right view just begins simply with generosity, of giving freely. Why is this at the beginning? Because generosity gladdens the heart. Being generous always makes us feel good, opens our heart to others in need around us. And it opens our heart to things outside ourselves. We start stepping outside this self view of, well, everything is just about me, into a view of looking at things in a broader sense and seeing our interconnection with everything. Then he says, then comes the results of good and bad actions. We need to understand that every intentional act of body and speech has consequences, and that these consequences shape our lives. Everything we say, everything we do right now, in this moment, has the potential to affect what's going to arise in our minds later, and in our bodies later, for that matter. And we keep forgetting this. We think, oh, well, I can get away with this. There's no such thing. We always have that sort of energy going forward. And it doesn't mean that, you know, everything that's going to happen in the future is based on what happens now. You know, that's also really clear. You know, the things we're partly affected by our actions, by our karma, if you want to use that word. But everything that's arising in this particular moment is based partly on that and partly on just like random factors and stuff. And, you know, as I read that sutta the other last time, I think, what the Buddha is saying, sometimes you just have gas. You know, it's not all simple, right? And don't worry about accepting the idea of reincarnation. So this implies this, and he's very much implying that in what he's saying here. Being, you know, it's so easy to fall into, well, I'm supposed to believe in reincarnation, right? That you have to believe in it. Joseph says a great thing. Joseph Goldstein says this great thing. He says, simply suspend your disbelief. You don't have to believe in reincarnation. You just suspend your disbelief. Let go of the fact that you're so sure it's wrong. And just be open. And as time goes on, it becomes clear as you go deeper into the practice that it just makes sense in a heartfelt way as opposed to an intellectual way. So basically, you know, let the path lead you to this understanding in time. Then he says, father and mother. Or actually he says mother and father. In India, mother always comes first. Interesting. And this is like being aware that we owe a debt to our father and mother. Simply because they brought us into the world and raised us. And this can be, I want to points out, this can be difficult to absorb and understand, especially if your relationship to your parents was, or is, or was, or still is, or whatever, a difficult one. But underneath all that, it's like, without them, we wouldn't be here. Which is an interesting thought, right? Without them, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be sitting here practicing. And that's a debt we have to understand. And it might be that it's like, oh, you might think if your parents are still around, oh, wouldn't it be nice to sort of, this Dhamma stuff really makes sense to me, I should share it with them. Be very careful with that. And, you know, if it seems that they wouldn't be comfortable with you talking about these things because of their background or their beliefs or whatever, just let who you are, who you're becoming based on the practice, be an example. That's all you need to do. They'll say, oh, it's, I really see, I recently had someone's father say to me, you know, this stuff is really good for him. Out of the blue. And I went, oh, interesting, you know, that someone would point that out, that they could see their child changing just based on their practice. And the same goes with other family members. Oh, well, my brother would really like this. Well, maybe he would, maybe he wouldn't. Guess what I'm saying is you don't want to proselytize in any sense of the word. Then he says this interesting thing. There are In the world, good and virtuous Vaikulas and Brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. In other words, these are people, there are people in the world right now who are realized beings. And this is like a continuous chain going back 2,600 years. By following the Buddha's teachings, people become enlightened beings. This is like natural, in a sense. I mean, if you read the Sutta is full of stories of people becoming enlightened, hanging out with the Buddha. Some very quickly, some like his disciple and nephew, Ananda, who was with the Buddha for 20 years. Imagine every day hanging out with the Buddha for 20 years, and he never reached enlightenment. Only after the Buddha had passed and they were having a big meeting of all the enlightened bhikkhus. The night before, he became enlightened, after the Buddha had passed. It's like, he was ripe, but he was just so busy taking care of the Buddha all the time, basically. Anyhow, it's interesting, and Joseph has something very interesting to say about this. I want to share this with you. This is from his book, Mindfulness. Our egalitarian values can sometimes diminish the understanding that there are actually people wiser than ourselves. Isn't that an interesting thought? There are actually people wiser than ourselves. Oh my God, it can't be serious, right? People from whom we can genuinely learn about the Dhamma, the truth, the way things are. Acknowledging this also keeps us open to wisdom from unexpected sources. We learn to listen for that voice of genuine experience rather than being influenced positively or negatively by personality or position. Recognizing that there are genuinely wise and awakened beings in the world helps us reaffirm the understanding that wisdom and awakening are possible for us as well. We can see the Buddha says very clearly we all have bodhicitta, we all have Buddha nature. We all have the possibility of awakening built in of being a human being. And we have to, that's sort of hard to take in, but if we look around and we look at people, even if we don't know people who are enlightened, like personally interact with people who are enlightened, you know, we interact with people who are like very clearly much, so much more deeply practiced and so much wiser than me. And you see that, you feel that with these people. Then it gives you that sense of, oh, this practice has possibility. It goes in the right direction, right? We can practice applying various aspects of mundane right view in different ways. Some may be obvious to us, like the practice of generosity, which bears wholesome fruit, or investigating our motivations and acting on the wholesome and letting go of the unwholesome. Other aspects of this right view may not be immediately apparent. We may want to experiment and see how they affect the quality of our lives. So here he's talking about this other aspect of right view where we go, well, it could be this or it could be that. Like we're exploring what it means to have right view. Sometimes it can be like, well, let's apply this particular idea of right view and spend a week doing that. You know, like experiment. Life's an experiment, right? And see what happens. Do I end up, you know, getting myself caught in a lot of trouble, or is everything really happily going that way? Oh, this might make sense. Oh no, that one didn't work. Let's modify that view until we find one that suits us. It isn't like there's a dogma that says this is right. Don't ever go into thinking, well, I've got it all figured out. Because that's the other thing about the whole Eightfold Path. We think of the path as a straight line, right? But actually, the Eightfold Path is a spiral or a circle. And we keep coming back around to right view and going, oh, now that I, you know, 5 years later, here I am thinking about this again, like, oh, I never thought of it quite that way before, but now I see, and we start having this sort of clear, we clarify our view based on our own our experience in the world and also the experience in our practice. So it's never, nothing's ever like simple and decided. This is the way it is. You know, we have to be careful about that. And then in the sutta, the Buddha says this really interesting thing. He says, one makes an effort to abandon wrong view and to enter upon right view. This is one's right effort. Mindfully one abandons wrong view. Mindfully one enters upon and abides in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus these three states run in circle around right view. That is right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. He's stating very clearly that this right view, wholesome view, right understanding, however the words you want to use, is a practice. This is something we have to practice. This isn't just something we figure it out once and now I'm done. It's like we're always practicing, and based on the effort we put into our practice and into how our mindfulness develops over time, we start to see things more clearly. It's not ever one and done. It's a process that's always ongoing, and it's affected by the other. You know, the other thing about saying about things about, like calling this the Eightfold Path, is paths sort of like, well, you take step one, then step two, then step three, like it's a line, right? But really, the Eightfold Path, all the pieces of the Eightfold Path interact with each other all the time. It's like this interesting stew of interesting practices that influence each other, and we tend towards more one than the other at various times in our life and in our practice, and then based on our understanding, among other things. So that's the first one. So right view in the world, I think, would be, you know, unaffected by taint, sort of implies in terms of relative reality in our world, is how we interact in the world. Then there's right view unaffected by taints, or noble right view, right? And this takes us back to the reason we practice. The reason we practice is because this practice leads to enlightenment. We can't ever forget this. You know, we can't be satisfied with something less, like being a good person or being happier. So those things all arise as we practice. You know, I want to learn to be calm and focused. Yeah, sure, that's going to happen too. But this is a practice, and it's stated very clearly over and over again. The Buddha says this practice leads to enlightenment. And anything else naturally occurs as our mind calms and focuses and we develop the practice. And we're always experiencing, as we practice, moments of enlightenment. It's called insights sometimes. Insight meditation, where have we heard that before? And all we're doing is, over time, we're accumulating and having these insight moments of insight occur more often, more clearly. That influences our practice, and then that means we want to go a little deeper. And the more often they occur, and the closer they get, we can see a process going here. We're not. And we don't want to be concerned about, well, I got to get to the end. And that becomes pretty obsessive if you're not careful. Instead, we want to be, can I see the process unfolding? Is this heading in the right direction? Am I somewhat happier and somewhat calmer than I was 10 years ago? Or whatever time frame you want to choose. That's what's important. That's how we can see this practice maturing in a sense. is another thing that Joseph has to say. Noble right view, which leads onward to nirvana, is described in two ways in the suttas. First, it is described as the wisdom factor of mind. It illuminates what arises so that we can know and understand things as they really are. A classic definition of mindfulness is seeing things as they really are. The arising of wisdom is like turning on a light in a darkened room. In the Abhidhamma, which is a commentary on the Buddhist teachings, the Buddhist psychology, wisdom is one of the 25 beautiful mental factors. So the Abhidhamma enumerates 25 wholesome mental factors, of which wisdom is one. Mindfulness, calm, concentration, loving kindness, equanimity, these are all wholesome. Second, noble right view is described in terms of its objective content, that is, what wisdom discovers as it illuminates our experience. And what might, and this is a quote from the sutta here, and what monks is right view? It is monks, the knowledge of dukkha, the knowledge of the origin of dukkha, the knowledge of the cessation of dukkha, and the knowledge of the way to, of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha. This is called right view. So it's an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It seems a little circular because we're talking about the Four Noble Truths, but it's like everything fits together in not in sort of straight little square boxes at all. Everything overlaps and interacts. The Buddha is so clear about emphasizing the importance of right view in promoting the welfare of beings. It's another quote from the sutta. Bhikkhus, I do not see even a single thing on account of which unarisen wholesome qualities arise and arisen wholesome qualities increase and expand so much as right view. This is the thing we need. It's like it's the beginning, it's the start, but it's also what we have to keep developing and getting more precise and clear. Mindfulness of the Four Noble Truths is, in fact, the last set of instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta. He's talking about how this can be a problem if we don't get take it. So if we look at the first three noble truths, you know, the nature of dukkha, the nature of the arising of dukkha, and the cause of the cessation of dukkha, if we start to understand those, just that in itself makes it clear that we have to practice in a way that leads towards enlightenment, because nothing else makes any sense. Nothing else makes any sense. Interesting way to think of it. There's nothing else that's an adequate solution to the problem. And we have to keep remembering this. Remember that one of the definitions of sati, which often gets translated as mindfulness, is also simply remembering. We just keep remembering, this is why I practice. This is where this is headed. This is why this is so important. Here's another thought. There's another teaching called the 10 Unwholesome Acts of Body, Speech, and Mind. The last one on the list is wrong view. Not having right view. And wrong view encompasses the other nine. You know, this seems like, aspects of speech and actions in the world and all kinds of things. And it all comes down to right view. That's where, when you boil it all down, this is what holds it all together. This is another thing Joseph has to say. Bhikkhus, this is quoting from the Buddha, I do not see a single thing so blameworthy as wrong view. Wrong view is the worst of the things that are blameworthy. What does the Buddha, why does the Buddha make such a strong declaration about this wrong view of self, which is the view that we have of separate self? This is because so many of our unwholesome actions with their attendant karmic results are born from it. As long as this view is the central understanding of our lives, and it is for most people, we spend energy and effort gratifying the self, defending it, holding on to it. And yet all this potic karmic activity is revolving around something that isn't even there. This is the obscuring power of delusion. I love that statement, the obscuring power of delusion. A few examples show how our ordinary way of viewing experience is unknowingly strengthening wrong view. I feel happy. I feel miserable. And I am delighted for all wrong views about mental feelings. When I first read that sentence, I went, huh? Then he goes on to explain, luckily. We take them, what is impersonal, the feeling tones, Vedana, right, to be I or mine. I want to do this, to see this, to hear this, to go there, are all delusions about the mental factor of desire to do. We add the I and mine to the working of an impersonal factor. I make an effort. I have concentration. This wrong view about those two qualities. We can analyze almost every aspect of our daily life and see how we are continually identifying with the different mind states, moods, and emotions that arise and creating and strengthening the sense of self in the process. It's the power of our own mental language. It's always that I am experiencing this, or I see this. Or speaking to someone else, you see this, for that matter, it's the same thing. One thing I've played with and is try and change my mental pattern of thought around things like this. And so instead of saying to myself, oh, I'm happy, can we say, happiness has arisen? Which is, there's no I there. This is acknowledging that the happiness is, that the experience in the moment is happiness. Happiness has arisen. Instead of I am happy, it takes away the self image and just acknowledges that happiness is there, which is a wise thing to notice, by the way, of course. But it could be sadness or anger or whatever. Anger has arisen. Not I'm an angry person. Anger has arisen. It's a shift in the imaging that arises from the mental, from the language we use to describe what's happening. Something, this is just a practice you can play with. I'm not saying it's for everybody. I've played with it from time to time, and I try and see to make that more my habitual way of seeing things, as opposed to inserting the I into the equation. So that's right understanding. Then we have right intention, or wise attention, or skillful. Sometimes I think of attention as skillful or wholesome. These are all, you know, words to use instead of right, which has a tinge of, well, this is right, so this must be wrong, sort of feeling to the whole idea. And basically, wholesome intention arises. The proximate cause of wholesome intention arising is wise view. Once we see, oh, this is how things are, I understand how things are, then the intention to do something about it arises. It's like a natural sequence in that sense. One thing leads to the next. So we clearly see the need to practice diligently. But how do we go about doing that? I came across this and I went, oh, this is a thought. The thought then is that there's three things we have to cultivate. Three things that our intention has to be based on. Renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. That's what our practice, that's the intention is motivated. The intentions we form are all motivated by those three things. Renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. Another way to think of this, intention is a mental formation that must arise before any act of body, speech, and mind. So intention in and of itself can be wholesome or unwholesome. Intention is just a mental formation, and we could all have the intention to go out and get roaring drunk in a bar. This would not be wholesome intention, but it's still intention, right? So it's not just intention, it's wholesome intention. Intention that leads towards renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. There's a famous teaching, a famous sutta about this guy named Angulimala. So Anguli means finger, and Mala means necklace. And Angulimala was a notorious bandit and murderer at the time of the Buddha. And every time he murdered somebody, he'd cut off one of their fingers and add it to his necklace. And he was very proud. He'd got up to, according to the story, he'd got up to 999 fingers. And then he heard the Buddha wasn't intact, so to speak. And actually, the Buddha was in this village teaching, and he started heading down this path. And the villagers said, oh no, don't go there, don't go there. That's where Angulimala lives, in the forest where you're headed. And the Buddha went, that's okay. And off he goes. And then Angulimala sees the Buddha, and he realizes, wow, what a great finish to my necklace, hitting a finger from this famous holy guy, right? And he starts chasing the Buddha. And the Buddha just keeps walking along steadily, calmly. And Angulimala is chasing after him. And no matter how fast Angulimala runs, you can't catch the Buddha, who's just walking along steadily. Until finally Angulimala gets so frustrated, he yells, stop, stop. What's going on here? And the Buddha stops, and Angulimala explains his frustration. How did you do that? And the Buddha taught him, right there on the spot, taught him Dhamma. And Angulimala woke up. Oh. Because he also had a very strong, he was really, really good with effort, right? He collected 999 fingers already. He was pretty good with the effort part. And he just had to direct it, had to have the right intention to direct that energy and effort in a wholesome direction. And right on the spot, after the Buddha talked to him, he became a disciple of the Buddha. And then, and the story goes on, it's kind of interesting. He goes on, so like, he's walking everywhere with the Buddha, like he's one of the disciples of the Buddha. And, this, you know, and everywhere he went, where people would recognize him as that old guy, Angulimala, but now he's in robes with the Buddha, so no one could do anything. No one, they couldn't hurt him or, you know, attack him or anything like that, even though they wanted to. But he'd come by with his begging bowl and put clods of dirt and excrement into his begging bowl all the time. And Angulimala complained about it, and the Buddha said, this is the result of your past actions. You have to live this out. And eventually, according to the longer form of the story, Angulimala becomes enlightened through his own effort. His intention, all he did was change from an unwholesome intention to a wholesome intention. do something better. So let's look at these three things, especially renunciation. Is this famous image story I like to tell. So here's one of those cartoons where you see a man climbing a cliff, and there's this little plateau, and there's almost obviously a very holy man sitting there, cross-legged, looking holy and calm. And the guide gets up to the little plateau, and he sees the holy man, and goes up to him, and he says, "Oh, what old great wise man, you know, how can I reach enlightenment?" The wise man says, "Follow the path of renunciation." The climber sort of pauses, looks around on the plateau, and says, "Is there anyone else up here I can talk to?" "No, I don't want to go there. No, renunciation." You know, and partly this is renunciation has a bad reputation. It's associated both with many scandals that supposed renunciates have been involved in. And it's not very much fun. Renunciation is. The opposite of fun is renunciation. Our culture glorifies the opposite, getting everything you can and not doing anything that isn't pleasurable. Sort of the opposite of renunciation is what our culture tells us to do. And basically, renunciation requires that you renounce some of what is commonly believed to be the source of happiness. Simply accumulating things and seeking pleasure. Not that owning many things and experiencing pleasure are bad. To be very clear here. There's nothing wrong with having stuff and enjoying it. There's a place where the Buddha gives instructions to a householder, famous householder. He says there's four things every householder can have. Should have some wholesome means to have income, to enjoy that income as long as they share it with those who are less needy, to live without debt, and to lead a virtuous life. For us, that's us. Us householders, that's what we're trying to do. But we're like, we see that as a source of real happiness, getting stuff and chasing after pleasure all the time just doesn't work. It's not a good solution to finding true happiness. They're unsatisfactory. So, and here's the problem: as soon as we form the intention to practice, to take this practice seriously, which I'm sure you all have done at this point, you wouldn't be here otherwise. Then we have more faced with decisions we have to make. You know, and this is simple in the sense of, well, if I'm going to sit for half an hour, whatever long period of time you sit every day, if you form that intention to be serious about your practice and have a daily practice, that means it's an hour or 45 minutes or whatever time period is, stuff you would normally be doing at the time, you're not going to do it anymore. And you have to sort of organize your life so you always have that same period of time every day. That means you have to renounce something. And that was the time I used to read all of the New York Times. And now, well, I just sort of skim the headlines. Or whatever it is you're giving up. But we have to let go of things to make room in our life for practice. Because we're all busy. We're householders. We all have stuff we have to do and things we got to take care of and obligations in the world. And we have to shift that schedule, that how we spend our time. We may have to start going to bed a little earlier, so if you feel like me, you like practicing early in the morning, that means you have to go to bed early. You can't stay up to, you know, watch Stephen Colbert at whatever. What time is Stephen Colbert on? It's 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. Late, you know, those late night talk show things. They're always entertaining, but we don't can't do that anymore. You can't stay up there. You have to, you're reading this great book and you have to put it down and go, that's me. I'm always reading a good book. And put it down and go, okay, that's enough for tonight. Now I need to go to sleep because I got to get up in the morning. We start shifting. This is renunciation. And renunciation arises out of the understanding that practice is more important than other things. It's really that simple. Practice is more important than other things. It becomes the most important thing in our lives. Or if not the most important, on the top two. You know, maybe our relationship with our family is also up there or something like that. But there's another thing, way you can think about renunciation, which I found quite useful as a way of putting this in context. You know, we could renounce having to be the way everybody expects us to be. That would make us fit in. We could go, I can renounce that. I don't have to be a certain way that our culture tells us I should be. I don't have to be the perfect consuming machine, which is basically what our culture tells us to be. Yeah. It's just, or whatever it is that you know, we can just renounce those things. Okay? No, I don't have to go there. I don't have to follow those societal rules. And I'm not saying, well, now I can go off and, you know, start robbing and stealing, because those are useful rules. But there's a lot of, you know, things that our culture tells us should be, in terms of, you know, beauty and money and all these sorts of issues. And we can just go, nah, I can renounce all of that. So realization can be a relief at times. Letting go of things that aren't so important anymore, or aren't important at all. Maybe never have been, we just didn't realize it. Once again, of course, Joseph has some things to say about this. He's talking about things in the sutta again. The question for us is how to put this step on the path into practice. Now, once again, this is everything in the Eightfold Path is a practice. It isn't like we figured out now, okay, I've got that one, now I can go on to the next step. And in this course, in the Middle Eighth Discourse, is called the Two Kinds of Thoughts. The Buddha suggests one way to begin. Cultivate a clear discernment of the kinds of thoughts that arise in our mind. The way to form wholesome attention is just to be mindful. Pay attention to the kinds of thoughts that arise in our mind. We can notice which thoughts are rooted in desire, ill will, or cruelty. Consciously reflect on the karma that they cause. And then abandon them. So we're renouncing harmful actions. And we can notice those thoughts inclining towards renunciation, goodwill, and compassion, reflect on their value, and then strengthen them in our lives. All of this is wise reflection in the service of the path. As we become more mindful of these two classes of thoughts, we are also become more aware of the strength and seductive powers of the unwholesome patterns. We start to see and not just act out of habit. We start to see something arise, and we go, ooh, that'd be kind of nice. Then we go, wow, but we know where that goes. We're mindful enough to not just react. Evil and aversion are said to be more dangerous than greed and desire, but easier to uproot, whereas desire is less dangerous, but harder to uproot. Just think. Ill will and anger are easier to see, easier to uproot, desire is less dangerous but harder to uproot because it seems so alluring and so natural. Well, of course, I got to have a piece of chocolate. I like chocolate, or whatever your desire is. Why is this? Ill will has more harmful consequences, but it is always unpleasant. Ever been really angry or upset or full of, you know, some sort of nasty energy and felt good about it? There might be some sort of self-righteous glow for a few minutes, but then it's like, oh, God, you just feel the energy of it. And you feel the reaction of the people, which is always going to be unpleasant. Whereas, sense desires, on the other hand, are usually associated with pleasure. And it's not always apparent why renouncing them is a good idea. And sometimes it is a good idea, and sometimes, but at the same time, you don't want to become fanatical. You know, there's no sense in setting the intention, I'm never going to eat chocolate again. It's just if you like chocolate, right? So it might be, well, maybe I'll just only have chocolate once a week. That might be a wholesome intention. You know, you're not putting so much of that stuff that isn't good for your body into your body, which means you're going to have a better chance of being, the mind being clear and calm because the body feels better. And this is, that's why they call this a practice. We all have to figure out where these lines are, right? And here's another view he has. As we reflect on the drawbacks of sense pleasures and the rewards of the renunciation, we often find difficulty even when we just hear the word renunciation. Have you all felt that, like that sort of squirming in your chair feeling? It can set up alarm bells within us, perhaps because we associate it with the repression of desires, with deprivation, with a rather bleak and austere lifestyle. So it's no wonder that our hearts don't leap up at the thought of it. But a more accurate and liberating understanding of renunciation would be the experience of non-addiction. Really interesting way, the experience of non-addiction. We all know the suffering bound up with addictions, whatever they might be. We might be addicted in one way or another to food, drugs, sex, alcohol, or perhaps more unnoticed to work, power, recognition, wealth, or even comfort. We can become addicted to and entranced by certain mind states and emotions, like incitement or intensity of fear. Witness the big audience for terrifying horror movies. Tomorrow's Halloween, right? Have you seen, I don't know if you ever go to Netflix or that, they're just full of all the great horror flicks that you can watch tomorrow night. Just sort of enjoy yourself at Halloween and scared the pants off yourself. Meditators can also get addicted to different meditative states, like rapture or calm. How often in our practice are we trying to recreate some experience we've had before? I'm very familiar with this one, right? We get addicted to investigation. We can become overly fascinated with everything we're discovering. At one point in my practice in Burma, when I had been there for several months, the mindfulness had become very sharp, and I was seeing extremely minute details about what was arising. When I reported this to Sayadaw Upandita, thinking that things were going very well, all he said was, "You're too attached to subtlety." This is Joseph, don't think you're too attached to subtlety. It was such a powerful reminder that the practice is about renunciation, about letting go. Everything in our practice is in service of that. It is best summed up in one line of the Diamond Sutra. Develop a mind that clings to naught, or rather, perhaps we could say, doesn't cling to anything. Develop a mind that doesn't cling to anything. like we get so impressed with how well our practice is going, how wise we're becoming, how good our meditation is. It's just another trap. We have to be even that. We have to see even that. We have to renounce that. Bigger one to renounce, because those are quite sometimes quite pleasurable spaces we're getting to. But we just get caught there. We get stuck if we're not careful. So that's renunciation. Then the other two things he listed in things that have to do with forming a right intention are simply a loving kindness and compassion. Can we, every time we do something, besides seeing that it's wholesome, can we see that it leads towards more loving kindness and compassion for the world and for the people in the world? Can we do that as well? That would be huge. But that's all part of right intention. Like, I'm not just doing this for myself, is what it's to say. You know, meditation, that's the other thing you have to watch for. Meditation becomes just something I do for myself. And it's not. It's for the whole world. And we have to keep that in mind all the time. That this is about, in our own very small way, changing the world. Maybe not so small way sometimes. Can we be aware of that and keep that in mind as well? So I'm not just practicing for myself ever. I'm practicing for the benefit of world. That's also wholesome intention. And this means that you're tuning in more and more to the interconnectedness of all beings and less to the idea of a separate self. That's where that's headed. And that's why it's so important that we have that clear intention. Of course, I have to finish with a bit of poetry here. This is from Dana Paul's book, Going and In. This is, I love this poem. It's called Surely This Is Love. I'm intimately connected with all that is. When you water your roots, my heart blossoms. When I see you smile, that's when I know I'm fully alive. As you were able to live in truth, I raise the roof on this house I am exploring. I throw the doors wide, let the breeze blow in the windows. When you grow, I know it is my own opening. You stretch, I breathe. I give and you receive. Just beneath the fabric of our lives, coiled, ready to spring, or budding like a rose, reaching out to embrace, or sitting bathed in grace and stillness, the singing, circling, radiant, one with everything. Surely, this is love.